Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. These are recordings of our end-of-year classes at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on December 26th, 28th, and 30th, 2017. These classes are an opportunity to review the insights our Sangha has developed into three marks of existence and knowledge and integration of the Eightfold Path. The integration of the Eightfold Path as a framework for awakening and for mindfulness of life as life occurs is built upon a strong foundation of concentration developed through Shamatha Vipassana meditation. The depth of understanding of our Sangha is remarkable, as shown by these discussions and the questions asked. If you find benefit from these recordings, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
I always have this feeling of just how fortunate I am to have a true and effective meditation practice. It does what it promises. But, you know, then there's some times when it just, I just have so much gratitude for it. And tonight was one, just sitting quietly and meditating. And it's just sometimes such a profound experience, isn't it? We're very fortunate that these teachings are still here. And that this Siddhartha Gautama decided to teach, because he wasn't too sure if it was going to work. But he did. Just to put in context what we'll talk about tonight, the Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, awakened to a profound understanding of the nature of suffering, and that suffering in the world originates in and is dependent on ignorance, a very specific ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And that's known as dependent origination. From ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. The second link in that chain of dependencies is that mental fabrications are dependent on ignorance in order to arise. And it is those mental fabrications, meaning things that we construct ourselves, we fabricate them, and the Buddha teaches we fabricate them over nothing or out of nothing. Another word for those type of fabrications would be assumptions, leads to a misunderstanding of who we are, the nature of self. The Buddha used the word anatta to describe that construct that we hold as ourselves, to remind us that it's not a self. Those views are rooted in wrong views, ignorant views, views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. They don't constitute a self, they're anatta, they're not a self. And it's because of trying to establish wrong views of self as a permanent, substantial being in an environment that is completely impermanent, anicca, that results in a life experience that is prone to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering, in a word, dukkha. So it's the interaction between wrong views of self within the impermanent environment, anatta and anicca, that results in dukkha. Those are the three marks of existence. So the Buddha taught Four Noble Truths to bring understanding to that common human problem. And the path that he taught as the framework for developing understanding was an Eightfold Path. And the reason why he taught that was very specific. It's the nature of ignorance to create very intricate and very powerful strategies to ignore its own ignorance. Ongoing ignorance depends on living within an ignorant view or a wrong view of ourselves in relation to the world. So the connection of understanding the three marks of existence. By developing the Eightfold Path, we're able to recognize and abandon all views, all wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. In other words, we're able to see things as they really are, the truth of the nature of human life in the world. By doing that, we're able to develop our own path to awakening, which means full human maturity. And the reason why I use that description is when we understand whatever we're doing, we have gained maturity about that. The most important aspect of maturity that we can gain as human beings is what it means to be a human being, doesn't it? That's what awakening means as it's defined by the Buddha. So I'd like to hear how your developing understanding rooted in Shamatha Vipassana meditation has been developing, and how you're integrating the framework of the Eightfold Path. And if your answer is none of the above, that's okay too. Because that's what this is about. That's what our Sangha is about, to learn that. We didn't, if as human beings, we didn't have to learn these things, gain knowledge. It's one of the big misnomers of modern Buddhism. There's nothing to gain, there's nothing to do. That's just foolish. But at the end of the year, all of you have been coming for quite a while. I'd really like to hear what you've learned, how you've applied it in your life, the differences it's made. And in that, in so doing, you're here almost every week. We know how supportive it is to each other to hear this. So, and then I'll probably cap this all off with what I learned, if anything. So, and again, ask any questions at all that you have that's Dhamma related. Let's start with Mary Beth. Good to see you tonight.
Yeah, you too. Been missing being here, and just doing great with my home practice for a while and the holiday times.
Yeah.
I've realized I've become quite aware of how not my favorite time of year it is. So, I mean, that kind of connects to one way in which meditation helps me is to, I liked how you changed the instruction a little bit during meditation today, and it struck me that, like, noticing, I can't remember, you said something about noticing the arising and dissolving of thoughts and feelings,
yeah,
and also the breath. So I think that's what you said or something, but
yep,
particularly the thoughts and the feelings, because I had been, you know, and I think I noticed that when you said it. Did you say it after the first 5 minutes? Or you said it at the beginning?
No, that was the instructions for the last 5 minutes.
Okay. Whatever it was, I had, you know, it helped clue me into the awareness of, you know, thoughts that triggered feelings that then, you know, I wasn't having them even 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
But also the ability to, like, interrupt the feeling. You know, like, I found myself, my thoughts drifting to, you know, a family member I saw yesterday that I have some worries about.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to just, like, interrupt, like, starting to feel like, oh, you know, concern. And not that I don't have that, but I don't think it necessarily helps that
yeah.
person to just worry, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't.
So in the moment, and this happened to be during meditation, but, you know, it occurred to me, like, in life, like, instead of worrying about this person, I just immediately kind of interrupted that feeling, and, you know, and in fact, then my thoughts still did wander, but my thoughts wandered to the idea of, like, writing this person a letter, you know, that I thought would be, you know, make a difference in their life kind of thing. So
mm-hmm.
instead of, so that awareness of the feelings translated into, wow, and, you know, and then the thoughts also followed. Well, I don't know if I'll actually do that. And then, but that was awareness too of, like, just how my days go by, and what I fill my time with.
Yeah.
That, you know, do I really, like, do meaningful stuff? Oh, and then just to share, like, this is all my thoughts, and then my thoughts moved on to, it's sort of like somewhat aware thoughts, at least, and awareness that I'm having thoughts, but I still. My mind was, you know, wandered to, like, how you know, I have moments of, like, kind of, like, awake, like, it seems like, I don't know, using the same word awareness doesn't seem right, but it is, of, like, almost like a gap between who I sort of think I am
yeah.
and, you know, this great person, you know, and that's not that I'm not. But my actions and my words and, you know, like, sometimes how I treat the people around me or what I do with my day-to-day, in my minutes and days, you know, often there's this gap between, you know, how I view myself. And I have this, you know, quite a lot recently. Like, it's almost like a, whoa. And it's not bad. It's just, I think, for me, meditation... helps me to, the whole practice helps me to see those things, but I think in ways I don't even know, like, I think when I, my practice is regular and when I'm meditating real regularly, it helps me to close that gap. don't know if that makes sense. It's absolutely. Not even like it's almost like I just sense it more than I really see it. But
But no, thank you so much. You are describing in a very practical way, gaining insight. And insight into the exactly what we were talking about. The idea of this person that you're worried about and the letter you might write, and that is probably a good thing, but when it rises to the level of distraction, which it is then, it's taking you out of what's occurring in the moment, then it creates a problem in your life. It creates additional suffering for you and maybe even for this other person. But using mindfulness of the breath, shamatha vipassana meditation, you're able to interrupt that thinking. That's exactly why it was taught. Another word for that was deepening concentration. You're no longer distracted by thoughts and feelings that arise. And the instructions during meditation relate directly to the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha teaches that as feelings arise, recognize that they're impermanent, come back to the sensation of breathing. You're teaching yourself through a tactile experience that the things that I've used in the past to describe who I am to the world are all impermanent. Yeah. My feelings, my thoughts. And when we finally develop that to the profound level that Kandana did when he first heard the Buddha teach, we'll recognize that all conditioned things, meaning all views of self that arise, are all subject to cessation. They arise and they pass away. And the breath is the perfect metaphor and, at the same time, a practical experience of the arising and passing away of all things. So you described it beautifully.
Yeah.
And the other thing about it's one of the things that the Buddha consistently emphasized was the need for a sangha, because it's so difficult to do it alone. I don't know. I honestly don't know. There's legends of people that went into caves for dozens of years and came out awakened, but what they subsequently taught, I didn't find it terribly awakening. It's very important to have the support of a sangha if we're going to continue with this. So I'm glad you're here, and thank you for bringing your insights tonight, too. Do you have anything else to ask her?
I think so.
Thank you. David, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. I'm very new to all this, but I kind of jumped in and immersed myself.
I sure did.
And sometimes I'm reading, and I have to push the book away, because it connects so strongly. And then 10 minutes later, I'm pushing the book away because I'm utterly confused. But one thing I can say is that it's changing my life. It hasn't changed my life. It's just continually changing. And I can see things slowing down. And, you know, like even Mary, she had some kind of doctor appointment. I just was able to, instead of trying to, you know, console her or, you know, be worried about her, I was like, this is where we are, and what will happen will happen. And, you know, it's like Mary had that example of the two boats in the river. And
somebody brought that to class one day.
Yeah.
I just love that.
Boats bump into each other and nobody's in them, so nothing's happened.
Nothing's happened.
Nothing's happened.
Versus two people bumping into each other and they're mad at each other. So that's all I have to say, but thank you.
Thank you, David. And in so doing, you weren't dismissing Mary needing a doctor. You were able to be much more mindfully present with her, because your mind wasn't distracted by reacting to it. And I would say you've developed the Dhamma remarkably quickly, that's not all that important, but at such a profound level, just from some of the questions you say.
It's very enjoyable to listen to you, and just, you know, I told Mary this a couple of weeks ago, that I had two great teachers in my life. One was Mrs. Bland when I was a senior in high school, who taught me I wasn't a C student, and you. Because of just the way you make it all very, you know, digestible.
Yeah. Thank you. That is the most important thing to me. If I'm going to do this, that I teach in a way that's useful. If it's not, you know, it's not. Well, thank you for saying that. I'm so glad you're part of our sangha. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. And I know those references David's talking about. I know who Mrs. Bland is and the faith that she put in him as a high school student. So long before I was even becoming Mrs. Allen. Yeah, I have a couple things to share. It occurs to me lately that when people ask you what you do or what we do, that meditation is one component of the Eightfold Path, that you're not a meditation teacher, that you're a practitioner and a teacher of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, right? And therefore, so I find that when I tell people, if someone says something's changed about me or we're talking or anything, I've always found it sort of fall hollow. If I say it's a meditation practice, it's too difficult to explain because people have to experience for themselves, right?
Yeah.
Or they have their own drive-by experience with something related to meditation or whatever. And I still don't have the perfect way to explain it to people, except to live it, right? And to live it and be an example of it. And lately, and I think I've expressed this a little bit recently, and maybe because of the Anapanasati Sutta, those teachings and that experience is that, like right from when I started about 2 years ago, I have a lot of commuting, right? I live southwest of Philadelphia, but I have business in central New Jersey and in Pennsylvania, so I'm in the car a lot. So right from the get-go, I was always listening. But differently now is listening and reading. And Lauren is a good example of this, of preparing for the class like you mean it, you know, with full intention. I think for a lot of us, we're so busy, and this is our refuge, and we come here, and we say things like, my best meditation is when I'm here, or I'm renewing my practice because I'm here, and all those are, you know, good things, right? But I think recently I've discovered that if you really want to live this, and we all do, on and off the cushion, there's work to be done. And I think you are very gentle in how you, through the Anapanasati Sutta, were recommending that people read the whole thing. And it's a lot to read. There's time to dedicate. You have to read and walk away and read and walk away. Then you have to talk about it with somebody who you can talk about it with in order to really get it all, because it's the entire Dhamma in that sutta. Well, of course, I could say that about every sutta. But from my personal experience, I am now preparing to be here. And I remember one day I said to Lorna, I said, you know, you just say some of the most beautiful things and I really appreciate it. And it feels like it's just coming off the cuff. And she said, no, I prepare to come here. I was like, well, that's a concept. You know, I'm just like blowing in here because I just got out of a meeting and I feel pretty good that I got here in time to be here. And so I'm coming from like corporate America, you know, and then sometimes coming in here and going, bleh. And so I think the benefit of the Sangha is, right, sometimes there are people that are, you know, investing in it a little differently than you, that you can learn from, and, you know, certainly Lauren is one of those people. And anyway, so I think with the Anapanasati Sutta, and I think because of that, but also I think because of David's engagement, and now it's a part of our daily life and our conversations to have someone to share that with, you know, in addition to my sisters, I feel much more of a student of it versus somebody who's coming to meditation once a week, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Let's see.
So I think that would be like valuable, you know, for anyone who's, you know, on this journey is to think about how to do that, because we're all busy and we all have crazy lives, but I think in some ways we're coming here for refuge, but we're also leaving here and letting a lot of things be a distraction to us. Anyway, so that's sort of how my practice is going. And anyway, I'm just very grateful. I'm grateful for everything that you're doing. I can't wait till your next book. I can't wait till our next retreat. I'm really excited about some of the topics you've thrown out that are possibly the theme for the retreat. And the retreat has been such a great way to immerse yourself and get away from, you know, I'm no less busy or more busy than anyone else, and it's such a great way to get away. And then the other thing is, I hope in 2018, we almost had a near experience with bringing our daughters here tonight, because we were all in Pittstown at my sister's for another family get together. But I look forward to 2018 to bringing my two daughters here as well. They know how important this is to our lives, and they can see the change in our lives for the better. So.
Wow.
That's great.
That your daughters appreciate the change in both of you has to be profound for your daughters to notice it. And that really is remarkable. And I'll take credit for being, I think I'm a good teacher, and I don't mind taking credit for that. But it's because of the material, you know? I mean, to me, the most fortunate thing ever, and certainly to me, is that these teachings are still available in a way that we can use it.
For you as a teacher is that you have a discipline, well, name anything from the Eightfold Path, you have a discipline and an effort to remain true and clear to the practical application of the Eightfold Path and the teachings.
Yes.
So that's a distinction unique to you versus many, I'm not trying to put you on a pedestal or anything, but different than other teachers, maybe, that have introduced other things. And I think that's part of the beauty of what many of us find, is that it's true and pure and practical and simple and not simple, and all those things.
Thank you for saying that. It's and I developed that level of authenticity by reading very carefully how the Buddha actually taught, not just what he taught, but to look at how is he teaching this, and why is there 84,000, just an imaginary number, different discourses when he's teaching exactly the same thing in each discourse? It's because everything was situational, but everything was in the context of Four Noble Truths. He never taught anything outside of that. And I remember when I realized that was important for my own understanding. There's nothing else besides Four Noble Truths, but there's a lot in developing that understanding. So thank you for all that. And also the mention of the importance of right effort. And people get that at different points, and some people never get it, and that's okay. But a practice becomes truly, deeply effective when you do take to it wholeheartedly, when you have that joyful engagement that we talked about in the last couple of weeks, that you realize the benefits of it, and you spend more than just a weekly meditation or even just a daily meditation. You start integrating the Eightfold Path into your life. And that part of it is, it's not all that complicated, but because it challenges our views, we have a lot of resistance to it. And the Buddha pointed that out in the Second Noble Truth. And the nature of ignorance, to ignore its own ignorance and create all these strategies, I'm too busy, I'm too far away, it's too cold, the kids are crying, whatever it might be. Those are all aspects of, or all strategies we use to ignore our own ignorance rather than take to the Dhamma practice. And they're reasonable. They're understandable. and they'll keep us all from awakening if we give in to them.
It seems like it's a scale. I know I sound like Helen right now, an analogy. But it's like a scale, you know, and you're busy, 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 and something brought you to this practice, right? Yeah. And then you incorporate like a little percentage in the scale, maybe shifts a little bit. And if we allow all this distraction, you know, to tip the scale all the time, that then we're out of balance,
yep.
right?
Yep.
But if you can increase the amount of the Dhamma in your life and reduce the distraction, you know, and like therein lies the balance and
the middle way.
And the figuring out that this distractions that we justify or we And they're real distractions, you know. So not discounting why we think they're such big things, but they're also wrapped up, I think, in the strategies that allow us to resist, avoid, avert, whatever it is, right? To not find that balance, and then you say, "Oh, whack."
Yeah, wow, that's great. Thank you, Helen.
I mean, that
really is. That's the essence of it. It is distractions. That's why we need a meditation. That's why the Buddha taught a meditation method that deepens concentration and doesn't get into... Remember, the Buddha practiced and mastered these two other... another common meditation techniques that were more about having manufactured mystical, so-called mystical experiences. And he said, basically, that's not it. That's foolish. I need a meditation practice that will teach me how to concentrate my distracted mind. And that's exactly what he came up with this meditation method... And as he taught in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness in the Anapanasati Sutta, to deepen our concentration so that we're not distracted by our own wrong views. Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Diane, good to see you tonight.
It's good to be here. Yes, it's changing my life. And yes, anybody could be here. And to have been on sort of the ground level with you and seen your teaching grow over the years, it's just it's something I'm very grateful for.
How long have you been coming?
Since some of the first meetings at Regalsville.
Wow, that was a while ago.
I don't know whether it's my age or a thicker ego or something that just it to get through the, you know, all of the distractions, the assumptions, the is difficult. This is not an easy path. I find days and weeks where it's extremely difficult. But one of the things that it's the concentration that I have is that I've learned to stay with me and not the ego me or the I-making me, but just to stay with the process, I guess, is more like it. And usually I would find before meditation, I would find a way to distract myself from the uncomfortable feelings and thoughts that were coming up and abandon myself. And I really don't relish or look forward joyfully to these moments of insanity that I experience as I go through the process. But yet at the same time, when those disturbances to my status quo, to the conditioned thinking, occur anymore, there is almost a welcoming attending the feelings rather than a dread. Sometimes when I'm in the middle of something, I think, oh my God, I can't believe how wrong I've been. And thank goodness you keep saying, be gentle with yourself. And those words come to me when I'm feeling like that, and that's probably the be gentle with yourself. Well, those four words are so profound for me because I think I've spent, you know, the better part of my life not being gentle with myself and seeking gentleness, and then there's a part of my conditioned thinking that almost rejects gentleness because it's weak, you know, supposedly weak. And changing my life. It's changing my life. I don't know. I could talk, you know, probably for a long time. People at work notice changes in me. I don't know whether my family has or anything. Talk about a toolbox, the Eightfold Path. You know, when there's any disturbance in the, at all anymore, it's like, okay, and then now the scan is for which factor, what am I doing? I mean, like recently the hindrances, I was really, and I think I'm still in some of the hindrances, but I'm aware of it. And that's extremely helpful, and it enables me to be gentle with myself. Okay, I see what you're doing. I'm beginning to have regular conversations with ego. And that's really kind of one of the most helpful tools is to recognize the voices in my head as who's talking. I just thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Diane. The insight you've gained into the importance of the Eightfold Path is really remarkable. And the learning to be the opposite of being gentle with yourself is being harsh with yourself. And so obviously if you're being harsh, if you're judging yourself harshly, it has to be rooted in wrong views, rooted in ignorance. And it can only continue that. So the importance of being gentle with ourselves as we recognize. And this is a point where some people begin to lose the path. When they realize that they have actually been ignorant of the way things really are. They've been living their life rooted in wrong views. At that point, you can start judging yourself harshly for that, for actually needing a Dhamma practice to awaken to. And that can be very discouraging. So it's important at that point to recognize that all that I need to do is to change my mind. Because that's really all it comes down to. You're going from a views that were rooted in ignorance. All this occurs in our minds. It's experienced out in the world when we're not awake because we're using the world to reflect everything back to us. But when we realize that all we're doing is changing our thinking, it becomes a very simple and direct thing to do. Because then we have the framework for recognizing wrong thinking or wrong views. We simply recognize it and abandon it. We don't mess around with it. There's another problem with a lot of modern Buddhism. It's taught to analyze these things that come up. All these things that come up are just distractions. And they're as impermanent as any feeling or thought that arises. What do? We come back to the sensation of breathing, and we recognize through developing the Eightfold Path, as Mary so really brilliantly described, as the reference for recognizing and abandoning wrong views. And in the end, we realize there's nothing there. Like the Buddha said, it's like foam on the ocean. When we get to the other side and we start experiencing the diminishing of the effects of wrong view, we realize there's nothing there. Nothing there. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Hello, Tracy. Oh,
yeah.
Happy Christmas.
Yeah. She may be there.
Yeah, could be. People have spoken very well tonight.
Yes.
If I can reach that standard, but maybe the most apparent way that the path has helped me is in, I hope, in gentle self-confidence.
Mm.
I was very unsure of myself, very unsure of life, didn't think very much of myself, a lot of negative thinking about myself, etc. This path has given me grounded my thoughts in common sense, which has helped me work out myself.
Mm.
And I think overall, if I've benefited, if I was to say which way, how have I benefited, I have benefited that way the most.
Mm-hmm.
I've benefited in other ways. I'm probably a bit more fortunate than some people that I've actually had a big change in life. When I came over here, I lived in England, came over here, and started to live in America. And what that does, which I've come to realize, is inadvertently, you just drop all your old thinking of how life should be, and you start thinking in another culture, another way, another culture, another community, different housing, different everything sort of, well, not everything's different, but there's a lot of different things. And where I was, I can remember when I lived in England, I was very rooted in how English people thought, and how you lived, how were the standards, and all that sort of stuff. You're just rooted in their culture. That's how you think. And then I moved to another country, moved to another culture, and your views change. Well, that is anatta. I mean, that it is impermanent. An example of how impermanent anatta is. I mean, I'd have said, when I lived in England, this is my life, this is how I am, this is it. So I have had a practical experience of seeing that anatta is just a pile of thoughts. It's just a pile of thoughts.
That we're hanging on to.
That we're hanging on to. It's just a pile of thoughts, yeah. And so I actually have had that experience, and I can see it in my own life. So you'd think I'd be really into this, but I still find it hard to get rid of my thoughts. But anyway, what is it? Five clinging aggregates that we used to make up. I sometimes think of the five clinging aggregates. I probably have a lot of work to do in each of them, but form. I still think this is it, my body is me. I'm working on it, thinking about it, understand how impermanent it is, understand the Buddha's teachings, but to break yourself away from thinking of yourself with the five clinging aggregates is very hard.
Yeah.
And understanding that, you know, we have this, we think that we're this character that we're not. It's just foam on the water. It's just not there. So I struggle and get a bit frustrated about it now and again. And then I think about 12 clinging aggregates. To me, the most important part of the 12 clinging aggregates is the first two words, from ignorance.
Are you talking about dependent origination?
Dependent origination, sorry. The 12 steps of dependent origination, I think that then you can forgive yourself. That is the forgiveness in the Dharma, that we are born ignorant of dependent origination of the Buddha's teachings, what he worked out. So I often just think we are just gentle with yourself because we are born ignorant of what the Buddha understood. So that's where that comes in. Some of the suttas you teach are very good. Fire Sutta, I think, is outstanding. It just explains the society. I think it's just an outstanding sutta. Also, the water.
The Alagadhapama Sutta, the water snakes.
Water snake as well, which you don't refer to very often, but.
I will now.
as Mary was saying, that it's difficult to explain the Dharma. If you know, to say, what do we do here? What do we talk about? What do you know? And we're keen to say, well, we meditate. Well, yeah, you say that, but it's difficult to explain. You know, I often think of the water snake is the sutta to be cautious of explaining the Dharma to somebody, because if you explain what it is, they get locked on that theme, and then they miss everything else. You know, they just. So I think the water snake is advising us to be cautious of explaining the Dharma when you've 10 minutes to talk to somebody, and there's all the conversations going around. You know, it's almost impossible.
It is.
And there's another sutta, I forgot what it was. I meant to mention. I can't remember it anyway. Anyway, in a general sense, doing meditation, always very finicky about doing that. I tend to listen to the talks before come into class, so I have an idea what you're going to talk about. In a general sense, I'm beginning to become more aware of how finicky and pernickety and what we think about throughout the day, and just how insignificant it is, how trivial it is that we think about, you know, the most trivial things, and that's how we spend our lives. I'm beginning to really realise that it's like the taste of your toothpaste, and you know, that's what we think about. You know? And I'm beginning to see that there's a bigger picture to this. To see that there is a bigger picture that we should be focusing on, and not the brand of toothpaste.
Yeah.
I'm beginning to sort of really feel that in myself. I think that's all I can just sort of put my finger on right now.
Thank you. The bigger picture is that there's nothing to take personal.
Yeah.
Because everything is in a process of becoming. And that points to the first aggregate of form. It doesn't mean that there's no... It doesn't mean that we don't have a physical body. That's ridiculous. Although some schools would teach that. But the Buddha's teaching is not to be enamored with your body. Why?
Yeah.
Because it's impermanent. It's a vehicle for developing awakening within. It's not much. I'm not gonna say it's useful for other things, but that's the primary purpose: to unite the body and the mind and to see things clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Don't take anything personal, because nothing is personal. It can't be. How could it be if it's impermanent? That's the sutta before the Aditya Pariyaya Sutta, the fire discourse on the not self characteristic. If it's impermanent, how could it be a self? How could you insist that that's a self if it's always changing? And that points directly to the development of understanding the three marks of existence in this present moment. And when we profoundly understand that, and all of you have expressed it in different ways, we understand that I am in a constant process of becoming. So what am I going to become? Am I going to not put the right effort in and continue to become more ignorant? Or am I going to put the effort in and become awakened? And that really is the choice that we have, that the framework of the Eightfold Path allows us to see and follow towards awakening. So, boy, what a...
Can I just add one
sure.
About the saga. Obviously, you do find the comments that all the saga members make very helpful, and I do. And they describe things in their way, and you can say, you sometimes do get a clearer picture of other people speaking about it.
Yeah.
Also, I wouldn't know where to go to find people who I sort of like and respect. I wouldn't know where to go in the world other than this room to find people that I like and respect as much as that I like and respect, in a general sense, our saga members.
Yeah.
I think it's... I don't know if we're all sort of like-minded or what it is, but and not a quality of, you know, when you say it like that, but it's, I think they're great people. I think they're great people, and I really like our saga members. You know, I only meet them here, I only listen to the comments, but you get you kind of get a feeling for who they are,
yeah.
And I think they're great. I think they're great people.
Thank you. I feel the same way. I think I was saying this to Matt the other day. It is remarkable the sangha that's come together and the regulars, that to a person, I'm honored to know each and every one of you, not just in this room, you know. And that really is remarkable. We are almost to a person, maybe to a person, so supportive of each other, and that really is remarkable. I was a part of different temples and sanghas, and there was never any of this. It really wasn't, you know. In fact, it was more like a social thing than anything else. But I think we are so focused on the Buddha's teaching that true compassion really just flows from that. And it really is remarkable. So, again, this tonight was a really remarkable class, too. It kind of unfolded the way I was, just the way I was clinging to it.
Liz and Helen send their love. Hopefully,
I hope to see them next week.
Family in from New England.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you all. Next week, we're going to start the Truth of Happiness course again. Probably for around 12 weeks, depending on how the weather affects the classes. But I think you all have a book to refer to, and that's always just it's an interesting thing for me to see from the first time we went through this as a sangha, which I think was 3 years ago, to now, and how those that have stayed with it have really developed it just the way it's the Buddha intended. That I used the word for the third time. That's remarkable too. Thank you. And I'll have the registration up for the next retreat right after the first of the year. And there'll be a lot of the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta is going to be incorporated more into the retreat than our last retreat. So I'll be continuing for that. So let's finish with metta. Are there any other questions or comments before we finish? All right, thank you. So let's finish with metta. You could find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body and be mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.